Blog Talk Radio. All too often these days, the factory whistle is falling silent in America. But there is a way to get American workers back to work. Start buying more American-made products. Now, a Michigan-based company is leading the way in this movement to strengthen our economy. It's called AmericanMadeProducts.com. AmericanMadeProducts.com is more than a way to purchase American-made products online quickly and securely. It's a way to get our economy moving in the right direction. Go online or call and speak to a live customer service representative. AmericanMadeProducts.com, a family company based on the belief in the American worker and the quality of American-made products. If you're an American manufacturer, big or small, and would like your products on our site, contact us. We add products daily. Tell your family, tell your friends, tell your employer about AmericanMadeProducts.com. Visit, shop, and watch America grow. AmericanMadeProducts.com.
Well, hello, everybody. I have...
Hello.
I have area code 734. You're on also.
Hi, it's me.
Okay. My mic's a little better that way. Okay. Hey, I planned the proper introduction this time.
Okay, this is Scott.
Hi, Scott.
And this is Rebecca. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Hi, how's everybody doing?
Well, I'm doing good. How about you?
Not too bad. I've had kind of a busy week, but everything's going good, I think.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I had a busy week, too. I'm sure Cindy has.
Always.
Is Donnie at the Kroger's tonight?
Oh, yes. He's in produce.
Okay. Well, I hope we're going to have a few people joining us. I had invited a few people to come in and listen to the show and chime in if they felt comfortable. And hopefully we're going to have that happen tonight.
Okay. Well, we've got area code 586. Just put up their hand. I've got you on.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello.
How are you this evening?
I'm doing good. How about you, Scott, and Rebecca, and I take it Don's not on?
Nope, he's working at Kroger tonight.
Ah, okay. All right. So who's this?
I'm his lovely wife, Cinnamon.
Hey, Cinnamon, how you doing? So what's the topic tonight?
Well, I hope we're going to talk about what we got going on our new site here.
Okay.
Well, go ahead. Hey, before we get rolling on this too far, I've got a question to ask everybody. Are we going to do a show next Sunday night?
I wouldn't see why not, because Thanksgiving is on the Thursday. So
I agree. Okay.
We could
plan on doing a show.
Okay.
Sounds good. So, Rebecca, do you wanna take off with what you gotta say? Okay.
Well, you know, as we've been talking for weeks now, we've been talking about organizing and bringing, you know, all the different sites together and locals and really starting to prepare ourselves for the Constitutional Convention and for the next contract and just really getting organized. And so we've been talking about it and doing here and there, but this past week I got the Facebook site up and the website up. So we have the Facebook site is linked. It will take you to the website, but the Facebook site is called Restore Unity Project. So if you type in www.facebook.com/RestoreUnityProject is what the address on Facebook would be. That's the site. And we have, it's been up for 3 days, and we've got 200 likes right now. It looks like it's reached almost 300 people.
Awesome.
And just trying to get it out there more. I've been trying to post the link on, you know, some locals that sites that I can, you know, post to, and, you know, there's sites that I know about that are UAW related, and just trying to connect with everybody. And the whole basis is what we've talked about is just is gaining our strength through unity again. And so just trying to bring everybody together and in a forum where we can use our strengths and educate each other and just really prepare ourselves as things are going, you know, things continue to happen that weaken our union. And so, like I said, we've been talking about this, and so it's out there, and I think you guys have been to the site. I'm not sure about you, Cinnamon, but I did invite you to that as well.
Okay.
So and then I did link it to the website then, which is more focused on educating for that upcoming constitutional convention, which some people will probably be like, what are we doing that for? You know, it's 2000. I put 2019. It's supposed to be 18, so I need to change that. But it's 2018. But as we've been talking, you know, they have their plan of what they want or who they want to take over. And we need to educate the members as to, you know, what our rights are to be able to say no. We want to have our own person come and run, or, you know, we want this to happen or whatever. And there's just too many in the membership that don't understand the process, what the responsibility of delegates are, and, you know, the whole thing. I mean, even myself, I just got notified today that I'm going to be getting my a response from the executive board on my appeal to the Constitutional Convention Committee for the union dues, the part-time union dues. And, you know, the Constitution says that gets appealed to the convention. And I thought, well, okay, you got to write it to somebody, right? So I wrote it to the Constitutional Convention. I was told it was not sent to the right place. They're going to forward it. But so that whole process, you know, now we're going to take that to the convention, and that'll be put before the delegates to decide whether or not my appeal has worth and merit, and we should be reimbursed or not. So, you know, that whole process, and a lot of people don't understand it. I'm just learning it, and I think, you know, it's like let's all learn together, because we need to support each other, and hopefully when we get there, you know, I called it the members convention. Let's make 2018 the members convention, not about the leadership. Let's make it about the members. And so that's kind of how I focus that. But
here. You know, I mean, I shared on Workers Replaces Union's Facebook page today. You know, General Motors is really proud. That they're going to be sending this on their GM Twitter account. The General Motors is installing 186,000 LED light bulbs and fixtures, and it's just one of many steps helping them save $73 million in energy costs this year alone. Now, coupled with a couple of facilities that are running off methane gas that is next to a couple of assembly plants, or the assembly plants that are right next to the their garbage facilities, and I mean, and that's good that we're trying to be, you know, go green and save energy and be smart with our resources and stuff. But if we're saving all this money, gee, there's no reason why they can't help the people out who are the members, the people who actually make the money for them, huh? But I'm glad that. Go ahead.
Oh, I just said exactly.
You know, but, I mean, that's in 1 year.
All the people that are listening to this show, if you can connect to a Restore Unity project and attach your locals to it, that would be greatly appreciated. We do need to get in touch with each local to make this happen. Everybody needs to be involved. And as Scott says, you know, these companies are finding ways to cut costs, which is great. Like at where I work, a lot of the lighting is they have sensors on them. So basically the lights don't turn on until you run underneath them and then the lights come on. So I don't know if that's really the best way to do it. I think that's kind of a safety concern because sometimes they don't turn on until exactly you get underneath them. But either way, cutting costs is good, and hopefully we can see that reflect in our wages at some point in time, since we did help these companies in their darkest times. I think, you know, outside of the 10 years that we were stagnant in our wages and pensions, this past contract, we didn't really go up in wages. Matter of fact, the little bit we did in a wage increase went towards our health care and the increase in the half hours, the half hour in union dues that we got to pay to the Solidarity House. And so,
that's a good topic.
This page that Rebecca's got is very important. The format is something we should have come out with a long time ago. Rebecca set up a good format on that page to connect all the locals, all the members, so we can find a way to reclaim our leadership and get our leadership to do what they're supposed to for the membership. So I'm sorry, Rebecca, go ahead.
No, that's okay. You brought up the union dues, and that is a prime example of people don't realize that come the next convention, that's got to be discussed and voted on again. That needs to be decreased. And we need to make sure it happens. We need to make sure that somebody doesn't slide it by and get it in there as a continued 2.5, because in the last, when it was voted on, there was a provision made that it would have to be renewed in the next one. Not that it would stay consistent, that it would stop. And if they wanted it to continue, it should be voted on again. So stuff like that, it's really important for people. I know that most of the people I know down here think that it's just that way. Well, it's not really. It's got to be voted on again. So it'll go back to 2.5.
And the people need to remember, too, that Dennis Williams said this is a new union, that we don't strike anymore. So if we're not going to strike anymore and we're going to climb under the sheets with management, then, yeah, give us that half hour back. If you're not going to use those union dues to build up the strike fund for the purpose of us standing up to the company when we actually need to strike, but then our leadership refuses to, then yeah, just don't steal our money, give it back to us.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the almost $400 million that disappeared out of our strike fund, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't see how the UAW could sit there and say that we spent almost $400 million on trying to unionize the South. I mean, where does that money go to? $400 million is no chump change. That's a lot of money. So
right.
Hotels and sending a few UAW representatives down South, I just don't see how you spend $400 million to try to unionize the South. And then to come out with nothing, you know, I mean – who do they unionize? The skilled trade?
They didn't get it.
The skilled trades under Volkswagen, maybe that's it, right?
Right. If that.
If that.
Well, where's the report on that? Where do we get to see the work that they completed? The accountability, where do we get to see that at?
That's a good
you
question.
Don't.
You know what? There should be a breakdown on that $400 million on how it was spent and where it was spent and where that money went to on the UAW international page just the breakdown where all that money went to. So there's some clarity to the membership on how that money was spent.
If you remember, they run 1 year behind. So we've seen 1 year that we had, I think 2014, we had, I want to say $980 million in a strike fund. And then the following year, we were sitting at $600. It's like, okay. And when you go through the financial reports, you don't see where there was an expenditure of almost $400 million. You don't see it, Brian. And that's just it. And I don't know how you would do that. You'd have to maybe FOIA that, you know, the Freedom of Information Act, and be very precise with your question, because you know they're going to have their legal team look at that. And if you don't ask the proper question in a proper way, you're just going to get a blanket answer.
Well, that $400 million should have been itemized on where that money went and broke down and put on the international website to where the membership could view it so they can have a better understanding how that money was spent. And
no, I absolutely agree.
If they're not going to itemize where that money went, I mean, maybe as a group of people, maybe we can go to the federal building downtown Detroit and have them do an audit on where that money went.
So
that'd be interesting.
It would. If people are willing to do it, I'm willing to get with them and help out in any way I can to make this happen.
So businesses provide quarterly, monthly, quarterly, yearly reports of their expenditures. So where is that on the UAW? Where are those reports?
I know what you're saying, and I don't know if they do a monthly expenditure, but to us, the general membership, we get that in one of our special issues of Solidarity Magazine.
I don't
and
get that
usually,
for some reason.
Right, well, it's online, Brian. You got to pull it offline.
Right.
So you're saying that what they provide is you don't know if it's monthly, but occasionally something comes
right
out in Solidarity.
Right,
okay.
Right. It's interesting. There's a lot of money, and it would drive you absolutely crazy. I know people who've been watching their finances for years. So it's more than an 8-hour-a-day job to try to figure all this stuff out. Dr. Tom Adams has done some stuff, you know, he's writing his book. And it takes a lot of time, energy, and money because you have to FOIA some of this information. And, you know, when you do that, you know, each item costs money. So,
well, the Solidarity House has accountants to take care of that. And so there's no reason why they can't break that down to the membership and itemize where that money has gone. And, so the membership has a better understanding of how their union dues are being spent from the leadership. So I why the membership is not making a big fuss over $400 million is beyond me.
Especially out of your strike fund that we don't use.
Yeah, that should be bothersome to a lot of people. It really should be, especially considering what our international reps make in salary and perks. And then to see $400 million on top of that just be diminished somewhere out of thin air, and we have no idea where that money has gone.
Right.
And nobody's making a ruckus about it.
Well, see an annual report in the January, February version of this year, so I'll download that. But I can say that if anybody's interested in that, I see a annual financial report in the January, February 2000. Oh, wait a minute.
But even even at January, February, you got to go back, 5 years when they started using that $400 million to unionize the South. We'd have to go back pretty far to find the information out on that $400 million because that's not a recent issue. That's a past issue that we would have to research and dig to find out where that money has gone.
I just want to pop in for we've got somebody on hold, area code 219. If you want to speak, press 1 on your keypad. If not, you can just continue to listen. Okay, you guys can go ahead.
But yeah, that's something that maybe when we meet up on that that's when we're supposed to meet up on the what'd you call that, Rebecca? When we meet up on
the Skype.
Yeah, the Skype meeting. That's something. That's one of the topics we should remember to talk about and figure out what we can do to dig up the information on that and how we can get the information on that and maybe talk about seeing if we can get some government agency to do an audit on the UAW to find out where that $400 million has gone. Because I'd hate to turn a blind eye to that and not find out, and to find out that $400 million lined somebody's pockets. Because if you guys remember that whole thing that went down with General Holyfield and James Hardy about them selling UAW jobs, and the head of Labor's department there at Chrysler was forced to retire. So if they're able to sell UAW jobs, two-tier jobs, and undermine the union from within by doing that, who's to say what happened to that $400 million? So that whole situation with them selling two-tier jobs was kind of swept under the rug as well, and nothing was done. As you know, General Holyfield ended up being forced to retire, and as well as James Hardy, when personally they shouldn't have been able to collect their pensions. That should have been taken from them, because had we pulled something like that, we would have lost our jobs. So, and I've said it before, when you got the UAW and these companies agreeing to slash equality out of the foundation that the union was built on, and we no longer support equality under our UAW leadership, I told you that without the equality, that undermines the union from within and divides the membership. And our leadership, and our leadership has been doing that for quite some time now, and that's why they've been able to get away with what they're getting away with. That's why they get away with selling two-tier jobs. That's why they get away with seeing $400 million disappear. That's why they get away with upping our union dues a half hour and saying we're not going to fuck anymore. Because they're doing some unethical things behind closed doors, and the membership feels powerless because they don't know how to beat that system.
Right. You know, I don't want to change the subject, so I'll talk about this a little bit later on. Well, exactly what you're talking about right now is you've got somebody that forced the UAW to go talk to Ford, whether you like the person or not. President-elect Trump put out something that maybe he probably shouldn't have, I don't know, on a Twitter account. I don't follow Twitter. But anyway, he mentioned something about the Lincoln plan, I guess, in Kentucky, and it completely blindsided the UAW, and now they have to talk to Ford about what's going on. And it's like, are you kidding me? I thought we were all partners here. I thought this was, you know, you're part of these corporations the way you're treating us. And as far as equality goes, you're right. All you got to do is look at the national contracts. You know, they have divided us on purpose.
Okay, I just want to interrupt. We've got area code 219 is joined us.
Hi, this is Scott Alderson. How are you guys doing?
Hey, Scott.
Hey,
Hi,
I've been listening to your conversation about, you know, where did the $400 million go? The first place to start to find that is to scrutinize the LM2 reports. Those are available for online. I believe you can even download them to be able to print them out and whatnot, but it's a lot to print out. The best thing to do is to access them through the Office of Labor Management Standards and scrutinize where the money was spent. And, you know, we can dwell on the staff and how much money was spent on staff, but to find the nitty-gritty where that $400 went, you'll have to go down and find out, you know, where in the South we've been spending money on hotels, on conference centers, on amusement parks. Those are the kind of things that were taking place. And you can access those LM2 reports all the way back to the year 2000. They're an annual report that each local and the international has to do every year.
Are those reports, are they itemized? Are they broke down how that money is spent?
They're broke down for anything over $5,000, I believe. Completely itemized, but they're itemized to large chunks. And then that can inform your Freedom of Information Act to make it more specific when you know exactly where you want to know more about. You know, maybe they spent $100,000 with the Hilton in Nashville, Tennessee. Okay.
So you're saying anything over $500,000 is
over
more.
Over $5,000.
Oh, over $5,000. Okay.
Yeah, it's itemized as far as sometimes it'll even say exactly what that was for. It might have been for a financial officers conference. It might have been for organizing. But I don't see many that actually say organizing by them. But that'll give you a starting point. That'll give you a basis of figuring out where that money went and how to ask the right question. As far as rolling back the dues increase, I think that needs to be done, but it needs to be done smartly. Before the dues increase went into effect, essentially absolutely nothing was going into the strike fund while we were taking out hundreds of thousands of dollars. So if we just roll back the dues increase, we're going to be back in the same situation where nothing's going into the strike fund. It's called rebates. And if you look in the Constitution in Article 16, and, you know, it bounces around a little bit, but essentially every single dime that was relegated for the strike fund is rebated back out at a rate of 95% per month. And that extra 5%, they wait till the end of the year, and then whatever they haven't spent on strikes, they rebate that back out too. And that rebate is distributed 53% to the locals and 47% to the International General Fund.
Right. So what about the interest off that money?
The interest does not stay in there either. That's also redistributed. And it's all laid out in Article 16 of the Constitution. I understand this because I served a term as financial secretary and went to 4 financial officer conferences. And we discussed all of this in the financial officer conferences. Your financial secretary from each of your locals should know this information.
Well, if they rebate this back, then how does the strike fund grow then?
It doesn't. It doesn't until they increase the dues. Now that the dues increase, all is going being dedicated towards the strike fund now. Now, that doesn't mean they're not taking out of it still, but at least there's money going into it to grow it.
If I remember right, at the convention that you went to, they got the dues increase for an extra half an hour. That's was specifically supposed to go to the new strike fund because the old strike fund is incorporated to something else. The whole different articles of incorporation with that.
They just changed the name of it. It was all the money that was in the old strike fund was still in the old strike fund, and as a matter of fact, our strike fund is bigger than most union strike funds. If you look at the steelworkers strike fund, I believe they had $200 million, but they don't have a clause in their constitution that says those rebates get cut off if it falls below $500 million. We have a clause that says if the strike fund falls below $500 million, those rebates, they stop. The money stops.
That's why they
didn't increase the strike fund to threaten the companies. They increased the strike fund so that those rebates would continue because the strike fund was getting close to that threshold and would have actually fallen below that threshold had they not increased the dues. And then the rebates that locals and the international count on to be able to run their business would have been cut off.
So let me ask you this. Out of the half hour increase, what is the percentage of that half hour that goes into the strike fund, and what is the percentage that goes back to the international for other purposes?
Of that half hour, 100% goes to the strike fund. Now, remember they changed the name of the strike fund to the strike and defense fund.
Right.
May have, and your financial secretaries have access to the monthly strike fund report. Now, I haven't looked at one in probably about 6 months. But they are trying to rebuild the strike fund. They're trying to build it back up. And so most of that money has been staying in there. But that name change, also, if you look at the language associated with that name change, it allows them to bypass the convention delegates to dip into the strike fund if the International Executive Board deems it necessary. All the $400 million that has evaporated, so to speak, out of the strike fund in the past, that has all been authorized by amendments to the Constitution that the delegates passed at the Constitutional Convention. And you can see those things if you have several of the past constitutions available. You can look back through there and see those $50 million transfers. $75 million transfers, $25 million per year transfer for 4 years, $60 million in between Constitutional Convention transfers that were approved by the delegates to the Constitutional Convention.
I'm assuming those delegates didn't really understand the concept on what they were voting on.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily assume that. A lot of the delegates are hopeful to curry favor with the administration caucus. So they're going to do what they're asked to do. Currying favor might mean product to their plan. Favor might mean a staff position. So back against the administration caucus and their wishes because of the carrot and stick.
But that's the problem. The delegates are sent there on behalf of the membership, not on behalf of the international. So if the international is basically threatening them by saying you either agree with us or we're going to punish your local, then that means there's something wrong with our union from within.
Yes, yes, there is. And that's what happens with a one-party state. That's why we need an alternative to the administration caucus. We need people that are willing to step up, like Gary Walker did the last two times, and run. Now, I've had conflict with Gary because he didn't announce it in a manner that would allow him to actually garner delegates that were elected because he was running. I mean, he waited until the convention to announce both times. So, you know, then the delegates couldn't be elected on the basis of, hey, we want to challenge the administration caucus. But he did step up, and he did give us opinion that something was wrong, an opportunity to have a challenge vote, we knew Gary wasn't going to win, but several of us voted for him because we don't like the direction that the union is going. It was to make that point.
So Scott, let me back up for a second. So if the half hour in union dues is going towards the strike fund, what are the other 2 hours going towards?
They're going towards the same things that they always went towards. So in other words, that 2 hours, 30% of it is supposed to go into the strike fund. But the language is still there for the rebates to rebate all of that back out. The interest from the strikes fund is delegated to different things like taking care of Black Lake or the education fund or an organizing fund. I don't know the specifics in front of me. I'm driving right now. I'm not looking at my constitution to tell you where those interests that interest goes. But all those things are still in place. It's only the extra half an hour that's going into the strike fund right now.
Right. That extra half hour is delegated to a new specific strike fund. The strike/defense fund, because of the amount of money that's involved in the IRS and the IRA and all of the legal stuff, there was a letter of incorporation attached to that. When they change that language on that, that changes that article of corporation. That's coming from somebody that you and I, Scott, both know, unless he's
mistaken. I don't know that to be true.
Because of the monies and the power that was in that. But I do know that was at the convention that you was at when they voted for that dues increase, which was, a fiasco. I mean, you know that firsthand. And how they treated you, but they also voted out of the new strike fund, out of the extra half hour now, going just specifically to the strike fund. Out of that, they then voted to take $15 million a year out of that new strike fund for a total of $60 million over 4 years. Did they not?
No. No, they voted to take $50 million at one time and transfer it out of the strike fund in June of 2014. The $60 million between conventions is still in the Constitution. So, and you better believe that they're transferring another $60 million out of the strike fund in between the last convention and the next convention. They're
gotcha.
Still getting that. That's still in there.
Oh, and
so,
by the way, that took five conventions, if I remember right. The old man probably told the story numerous times. It took him five conventions to be able to get that interest off of the strike fund to go back to the basically his general funds. Now, it took him, like I said, five conventions. It took him over 20 years to pull that off. Brian, if you remember that little bit of history, like Scott's talking about, but it's there,
right?
And it was voted on.
I just want to say, Rebecca, you're back on.
Yes, thanks. Sorry.
I want to let you know.
Did we lose you?
I did. I accidentally hung up on you guys. I was like, dang,
oh,
I was
no.
in the middle. I really appreciate Scott, his information, his input. I enjoyed hearing it, and I lost him because somebody was trying to call me. I was trying to hang up on their call, and I hung up on you guys.
Well, he's got great advice about going to the LM2, and it is. It's a tedious process to get to it, and I agree with him. Unless, you got the time, the money, and you want to sit there and print out, I think it's like 78 pages or 80 pages. It's a lot to print them out. You can just download that on your computer, I believe it's a PDF file or a PDF reader, and you can sit there and go through that because it is a lot. He's not kidding you. It is a lot. And I've done that before. And I've seen where some people's salaries are at. They'll put every salary in it. Like you said, expenditures will be out there. But there's more to it than that because sometimes you need to look somewhere else. And I went to the Department of Labor, and that's how I found that information about the president, the vice president, and all the regional directors are getting a salary from the VEBA as honorary trustee. That wasn't
right.
on the LM2.
Right,
go
that's
ahead.
In the 990.
Right.
That's an IRS filing, the 990. And
right.
That's the filing that keeps the union as a nonprofit status, profit entity. And they have to document on there if they're drawing a salary from another entity and what that entity is. So that's where you can trace that back to the VEBA. The VEBA also has to put out a 990, fill out a 990
Correct.
For the IRS. And that's where that information can be found.
But if the UAW agreed to that VEBA, why are they collecting from it? Why do they get a salary for being on that board? Was it approved by the delegates? I mean, who says that they have a right to collect any income from sitting on that board?
That had nothing to do with the Constitution. It has nothing to do with the Constitutional Convention. Those are contractual, and you have to remember that the UAW is wider and broader than just the Big Three. The VEBA is specific to the Big Three. So those are contractual issues, and the trustees to the VEBA, when it was set up, they're the ones that have, and of course they were picked by the UAW. So it's kind of like my ex-governor, Mitch Daniels in Indiana, when he picked the trustees for Purdue University. And then when he retired from governorship, when he was term limited out, he got to be president of the university, of Purdue University, because the trustees that he handpicked picked him for that job and that salary. That's the same thing that's happening with the UAW and the VEBA.
So the UAW
right.
agrees to the VEBA, and they get to elect themselves to be on that board.
The trustees that they put in place are the ones that elected them to be on the board. Be on the board. There's no election.
Well, that's kind of a conflict of interest.
Okay. You got to prove that. You got to take it to court to prove it. You can say it all you want, but that don't make it. That doesn't change anything.
Well, no,
right.
I don't change anything, but it's obvious that it is, and if anybody, any of the memberships don't see that, I mean, to me, it just shows that the international's not working for their members; they're working for themselves and for the companies.
Well
anybody
let's
that's
say
paying
this.
Attention knows that.
Right. Let's say this: what they're doing might not be illegal. We're not going to argue this conflict of interest. I agree with you. It might not be illegal, but we might say that it's highly unethical. Maybe not illegal, but might unethical.
Right. And,
because,
and
you know,
and it's just as unethical as the President of the United States having business ties to foreign countries.
Agreed.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Like I said, we're not the first ones to talk about this. I'm sure other people have actually went to court and sometime and realized that it takes, one, a lot of time, two, a lot of money to try to get this information out. And it's a huge endeavor. And then you've got, oh, my goodness. I mean, I hate to think what the legal team is that the board, the trust board, would hire to represent the VEBA, let alone the UAW lawyers, you know, and then I'm sure then the big three would have to send some of their lawyers, too, because of the money that they pay in to the VEBA. So it's, you know what I'm saying? You'd have a whole slew of corporate lawyers teaming up at one table against, let's say, like Brian and Scott and Rebecca all showing up with a couple of lawyers. They got a whole team.
You can take the company out of the equation, because once they paid into it, that's it. What they put in there, they're not required to put anything else in there. Now they can
right. They
can agree contractually to go ahead and add to it later on if you know they negotiate that in some future agreement, which they're not likely to do, but they're out of the picture now. It's the VEBA
right.
Trust Fund, it's the VEBA Trust Fund, and the UAW oversight of that, and
right.
really the UAW is something separate from it, but as we can see, it's really not.
Right, and because I forgot about that. Ron Gettelfinger, with one fell swoop, took billions of dollars out of the VEBA by allowing corporations, well, I know General Motors, a free pass for the two installments that they owed, if you remember that. I mean, and you're right, I forgot, they're done. It's we fund the VEBA now. Yep, and then why people
now,
are
now
thinking.
The only tie
ahead.
To it now is the company stock that's still in it. And I'm not sure at this point how much company stock is left in it. You know, Dick Dangin is
right. Somebody
that does a lot of research on that kind of thing. And he could probably tell you, if you were on the show right now, he could probably tell you how much company stock is left in the VEBA. Or at least to a close proximity, and they're supposed to be divesting from that. Whether they have actually divested, I couldn't tell you.
And that's not just common stock, neither. That's preferred stock.
No, actually, it's lower stock because they have had to hold on to it a certain amount of time, and there was a cap on how much it could. Increase if memory serves me right. So the company was only required to allow that stock, that special stock that the VEBA held, was capped at like a 200% gain. So if it tripled, you only got 200%. You only got double. So it was actually a less than preferred stock in my eyes, anyway. I'm completely off base on this, and that's what I thought I had read in some of the financial magazines back when it was going into place.
Right. I gotcha. All right. Well, hey. You know, we do appreciate you calling in and giving us insight on this. I mean, it's it's just more information for, you know, people who are listening so they can understand kind of what goes on. I will say I was surprised. Somebody sat down with me. It was a very long, drawn-out process. And I'm talking better part of 2.5 hours and find that 990. It's a process. You start at the IRS. No,
the
LM2
is much easier to find.
And if you, and I will say this from experience, if you make a mistake and click the wrong link and go back, you have to start all over at square one. I want to say it's like 16 steps to find the 990. When I found that, that's where I found that information you're talking about, the honorary trustees, such as the executive board and the regional directors. And also you find by name who are the trustees, the administrator, the lawyer, the chief financial officer for the VEBA. Their names are listed on there also, as well as their salaries. You know, you're looking at, I want to say just under $3 million or around $3 million is what the administrators get paid out of the VEBA. That was just for the General Motors one. I didn't look at the Ford and the Chrysler's, their administrative board for the trust. So it's interesting, but it's very hard to find. And I found it. When I got there, I made copies of it. Once you get there, make copies, because one wrong button and you have to start all over again and you'll just pull your hair out. So,
yeah, here it is at the UAW created lucrative positions for themselves to oversee the retirees' health care is beyond me.
Right, right. It gets disheartening when you see what they do sometimes, you know.
Hey, Scott, I appreciate you coming on, and we communicated a little just by messaging, and I hope that you'll join us more on the site, and hopefully with our organizing members to come together in the summit we want to do early next year to help educate. And so it's so nice to hear. I mean, we have a lot of information. These guys are pretty smart, but it's nice to hear your view as well. And I'm wondering if you know, maybe a little more on a more simple or basic contractual thing of what's going on. Do you know anything about the attorneys and these issues that are in our current contract that still haven't happened and it's been a year? Do you have any updates? Do you know anything on status as far as that goes?
No, I'm, you know, the benefits reps are kind of the experts on this. They get briefed, and if you have a good benefits rep that's paying attention when they go to these benefits conferences, they can tell you that I think what they'll tell you is that the company is having some kind of trouble getting the legal groundwork of it worked out. What that means to, I don't have a clue. You know, it seems to me that it's cut and dried, it's contractual, that it's something that they should just do. But, they've been delaying this for more than a year now, and they keep pushing the goalpost back. Yeah, it'll be done, you know, a couple months from now, and then a couple months comes around and they get pushed back further. I don't know what the particular issues are.
So basically the UAW made us ratify a contract that they didn't have the details worked out on.
Oh, yeah.
Well, who's responsible for that? Who's responsible for that? I mean, they said they were going to provide it. We got people like I seen somebody today. They're like, I really need an attorney. I've got to go to court, and I can't afford it. And could our members charge the UAW for the attorney they pay for? Because we're supposed to, in our contract, says we're supposed to have one.
You'd have to ask an attorney. To be yeah. I don't mean to, crack a joke about it, but, what you're talking about is doing the UAW for breach of contract, or the UAW and the company for breach of contract, and you can't do that within the framework of the contract. You would have to get an attorney that's willing to take that case on, and I'm not sure whether any are.
Right.
Well, I can say Scott, you're probably not familiar, or maybe you've heard. I filed an appeal on part-time workers' union dues that we're overpaying, and it's gotten to now. It's going to the Constitutional Convention, I've been trying to find an attorney for that, and it is amazing to me. Yeah, you're right. Nobody wants to touch it, and I'm like, listen, somebody's got to, help us here, because we have this organization who's supposed to be representing us and is not completely doing their job.
You're not going to be able to use legal services against the UAW.
Well, not our own, but when I referenced wanting to do
right.
that. I know that.
Legal services for a simple divorce, or
right.
You might get help or a discount for a bankruptcy proceeding or a real estate transaction, something like that. That's what you use legal services for.
Right. It was a custody thing. It was a custody thing they were trying to do. So I think that probably is.
Yeah, and legal services probably would not pick that up. They may find a lawyer that will do it at a discount, but understand mm-hmm. with the custody thing, and I've been through it before, you get what you pay for.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
It they do nothing but evening all, Jones here.
Yeah, I've tried using a legal support legal service recommended lawyer for a divorce and custody, and ended up staying not getting a divorce for a few more years because it was just so painful. And I paid for my own, and the results were much better.
The new legal service, it's nothing but paperwork. There's no court appearances by any of the attorneys that we get for free. That's per the new contract. And I just want to touch on something because I was listening in the queue for a minute. You can go back to the contracts from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, 2000. There's always a book of letters at which point the company says we're going to do this, we're going to do that. International says we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And they renegotiate after the fact. That's why there's always a book of letters.
Oh, hold on. Somebody's got a speaker on because there's background noise.
Mine are off.
All right, go ahead, because I heard a lot of background noise.
Somebody does.
We'll try that. Any better?
There's still a little bit better. I still hear it.
Here, I'll tell you what. Let me hang up. I'll call back in and see if it gets any better.
Okay.
It must have been him then.
Okay.
Well, anyway, it's real interesting. There's a lot of stuff out there. We're hearing about the legal service. We've been getting the runaround at General Motors and our plan about it, and it's a running joke now. It's like the check's in the mail, and it's just hard.
But when do we stop joking about it and say enough is enough? Somebody. Take responsibility for this, and we're tired of waiting, just like our contract book. When are we going to get one? Who is going to step out? And where do we go and say, It's time. It's time. You need to provide us with the services that are in our contract. Every one of them.
Well, maybe Scott would be able to answer that. Who do we question that about? Is Scott still there?
He's still here. He's still here.
I had it on mute. I'm not sure which Scott you were talking to.
Oh, just you. Scott Holderson.
Okay. Who should be held accountable for that? Well, obviously the parties that negotiated the contract.
Well, I mean, who are we going to? Who do I need to go to and say I'm tired?
Dennis Williams, and if it's a Ford contract, Jimmy Settle. If it's a GM contract, Cindy Estrada. If it's a Chrysler contract, Jewel. Start with Jewel.
The bottom line is you can't just go to them. So what would be the solution the international negotiators to honor what was negotiated in this contract? So what would be your suggestion?
Start by writing them a letter certified so that you have proof that it was sent, and they will reply to that letter. And then you have their reply to it, and then from there you can do what you want with that reply. You can remind them again that this is a contract that they negotiated. They need to make the companies live up to it, and take it to the NLRB. Once you have the documentation, but write the letter to them first to get the documentation.
Right. It's all process. This whole thing is all processes and more hoops for you to jump through. But they're there. They're there for a reason. And like Scott said, you start with a paper trail and then, eventually where you want to go with it, because they'll give you an answer, because it's a legal question, a contractual question. I would start with, like you said, the negotiating party, Dennis Williams, and then carbon copy that to Cindy Estrada and make them both have an answer. It'll take a while.
But the contract was settled last October. Don't you have 6 months to file a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board? So we're past due on that. Or does it depend on the complaint?
Good question.
I don't know the answer to that question, Brian.
Because this has been an ongoing problem with the international and the company not honoring all the contract. Therefore, I don't know how the National Labor Relations Board is going to review it, but something has to be done. And following the process is nothing but red tape, and it takes way too long. And
well,
for somebody,
the red tape is the process, and you're going to have to follow it, or you're not going to get anywhere.
I'm still hearing background noise.
Yeah, it's like Rebecca trying to see if there's going to be a refund for them taking too much dues from what Rand said as a contractual language on the temporary. Okay. That's when, I don't know if Scott was, when we listened to that, that's what she was referring to, because they had an agreement with the temporaries that at a certain point they're only going to make them pay so much. Well, they continued paying more, and that's where she's getting the, I call it the runaround from international. So
yeah,
that's what he's saying is a process.
Yeah, and with regard to that, I believe the part-time some administrative letters regarding part-time employment and reduce union dues because of part-time employment. And I believe that threshold is 40 hours per month. So if you're working more than 40 hours per month, they're probably going to hit you up for your full union dues. There's an administrative letter that the financial secretaries get in their financial secretary manual that was issued decades ago that described what happens if a union dues paying member is working part time. They describe that you have to have 40 hours in a month to pay full union dues.
Right. Okay. Well, it's somewhat disheartening for some of these people that are new to the UAW to come in and with the contractual changes that happened on these contracts, and then see that they're not going to be full pay scale like you and I. They're going to be not eligible for certain bonuses for a year for this or for that. It's disheartening for these poor people. And then to think that, they think they've been paying a little, for other words, too much on the union dues, the representation they're getting. And then when they ask about that, they, like you said, there's a process there. And that process is very long and drawn out for a reason. So,
all I know is back in the day when the union first started, there was no process. Their process was with their hands. And so I think going through that solidarity gate would eliminate their process, and we can start our own process. Because as far as I'm concerned, we're wasting time here. Because all they're going to do is give us the runaround. And we're going to be sitting in limbo waiting for them to lie to us as time goes by, and we're not moving forward. So, it's always been my belief that the membership should gather in front of that Solidarity House and demand and force our leadership to honor that contract. And to give us what is due to us. We are paying union dues, and we want it now. Because we don't work for the Solidarity House. The Solidarity House is supposed to work for us. We are paying them union dues. And if they refuse to represent us, maybe they need to step aside, or maybe we need to force them out and put somebody in their place. Because as it looks now, we ain't getting what we're paying for. So
I think the only coup that we're going to accomplish is through the ballot box and taking over our union. When these people that are frustrated with the tiered system and not getting the bonuses and things like that, if they're frustrated enough and educated enough, they'll find out that they have the power if they assert it. But so far, they haven't been willing to assert.
Well, I just know in the past at the convention, you've been a one-man army primarily, Scott. And There might be a handful of you, but not enough to make that change that we need.
That's right. That's why we have to make the changes that are local and fight and our local to educate our members about the process.
But right. you know how long that would take? Our local leadership don't even want to educate the membership. And if these people don't know where to go to get that education, they're never going to be educated.
You know better than anybody. We're educating on this program. You know better than anybody, Brian, that you don't need a title to be a leader.
That's true.
Right. Hear, hear.
That I agree with.
Well, I mean, and Scott Scott Hobson's defense, they just didn't do this in 2 or 3, 4 years. It took them quite a while to get their local where it's at now, correct?
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
I wouldn't call our local in a good place either. And we sent five people to the Constitutional Convention, and only two of us voted against the dues increase.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Well, that's not good.
There you go. That should tell you something. The system don't work.
Yeah, there's still work to be done. That's what it tells you.
Right.
Because I'm saying the system don't work because it's evident that the union has divided the membership, and so you got three people going down there voting for it, and you got two people voting against it. So, I mean, a union divided is not going to be down at the convention in solidarity because you got half the membership believing this, and then you got the other half of the membership believing that. Why? Because half of them are sheeps, if not majority of them.
What do you think the union was like in 1946 when Reuther challenged Thomas for the presidency and won it by a narrow margin? Do you think that was a united union?
Well, I'm sure it wasn't.
I mean, why do you think
there's
always going to
be differences of opinions and different approaches? We need to persuade the membership that our approach is better than their approach, which shouldn't be all that hard.
No.
It shouldn't be, but it has been. Because these people are scared. They are more divided now than they ever have been, and they don't have the answers. And because they don't have the answers or the education, they are afraid to make any moves. Because they are afraid that the leadership will respond back in a negative way, or they're too scared to even step out there to make that change.
We do have Jones back on the
line. Oh, I'm back.
Hi, Jones.
No feedback. Everybody good tonight?
Yeah, we're good now, Jones.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm just going to touch on something real quick. I disagree. I think we need to get the membership the information. Based upon what the membership wants to do with that information is going to be strictly and solely on them. If they have the information, then hopefully they make a better decision than what they've been making. But, I mean, we can't force them to do anything just like anybody's vote, the presidential election, so on and so forth. But they need that information. We need that transparency from international all the way down. And Rebecca, going back to what Brian said, I'm holding in my hand the 2011 Book of Letters, which is 424 pages, which was in the agreement that was put out that international and the company would renegotiate or sit down and talk about it later. The contract goes through that international and corporate have that power to sit down and renegotiate this. And a lot of members don't have this. They don't even know what it is. They don't know where to get it at. And they can all get it at their local if they go down there and ask for the Book of Letters. But that's part of the reason why it's taking so long is due to the fact that they're still negotiating the contract that we already passed due to the fact that we passed it and there's things in there that they left wide open that they would sit down at a later date, sit down and negotiate, so on and so forth. And going back to the legal, in case it got broken up when I said it, legal, when it comes around 2017, early May, February, March, whenever, is only going to be for documentation, no court appearances, period, point blank. So, I mean, those are just some things to consider. Like I said, you can go back to the 70s. I got contract books actually going back to the 50s. Always a book of letters because even though the membership puts it through, there's things always negotiated after the fact the membership never knows about, never has a chance to vote on because it's basically said to that they're going to sit down, figure it out later. Everybody's looking at, not everybody, but let's say the majority of new members are looking at monetary, so on and so forth, and not looking at a lot of things that are in there that's saying, okay, we'll do this after the fact. Push this through, and then we'll sit down and figure out after the fact, after you push it through, to which you're not going to have any choice, but this is what we did. You approved it. And that's it.
But see, this is what gets me peeved. These contracts are set up for 4 years, We vote on them. We ratify them. They're supposed to be set in concrete for 4 years. Now, the international leadership is playing us by leaving parts of that language open so they can negotiate in the middle of the contract as time goes by. And they're not telling the membership this. And the people are basically voting on an open contract that can be changed at will, and that's bothersome. And the fact that you guys are, the fact that the membership is voting on an open contract, and majority of them don't know that, and majority don't know a lot of that language falls behind that zipper clause. They don't see a lot of that language. And, you know, things are being changed at will within the 4 years. That should piss a lot of people off, because the international and these companies got 4 years to meet, negotiate that contract ahead of time, and they decide to negotiate that contract after it's been ratified. That should be bothersome to everybody, because you are voting yes on an open contract with no guarantees of nothing but getting screwed.
Two contracts ago. Go ahead.
All the letters, all the language for the contract was available online for download, to review. Yeah, it's hard. There was a lot to go through in a short period of time. But there was information out there saying exactly what you're saying now, that these are living agreements, they're open contracts. That allows for changes in the middle of the contract. That information was given to the membership, and they chose to ignore it. Maybe it wasn't given to enough of the membership. I don't know what the answer is. But the fact is that now we have that language when our contracts are negotiated. We have that available to us. We didn't used to. We used to vote on just highlights. Before 2007, we were voting on just highlights. I don't remember ever before that having actual contract language available to the rank and file members before they got to vote on it. Do you?
I'm not disagreeing with you, but what I'm saying is a lot of the membership now are TPTs in Tier 2, and they are not being told this information. They are not being told where they can get the information. And so, therefore, and a lot of people got busy schedules. So, on top of that, unless the international is verbally telling the membership what they're doing, the membership don't know, and they're not going to look for it. So, I think because the international is setting it up this way, it's only right that they use clarity when talking to the membership. And they should verbally tell the membership that, look, there's a contract that you don't see, therefore you have the right to negotiate after you ratified certain parts of the contract. I think the international should tell the membership this verbally. Not for them to find out this information, because a lot of these people just don't know where to get the information from. The majority of the tier ones know that information, but a lot of the two tiers and TPTs don't.
No, not true. Absolutely not true. And the reason
I disagree.
No. I'm not saying that Tier 1 versus Tier 2s know or don't know. I'm not saying that the information was available. This has been a long time coming, going to before any of us started at Chrysler, GM, and or Ford, any UAW member. This has been a long time coming. Right now in my hand, I got a contract book that goes back to 1960. It's a book of letters that was not published. It was basically saying they were going to negotiate after the fact on certain sections and move forward with it, and it's not nearly 423 pages. It's a whopping 100 pages, 99 pages. This has been a long time coming. There's certain information and certain negotiations that they've been doing, past, practice, present, that go way back when, and it's been leading up to this. So we went from back to 1960 with 99 pages to 424 pages in 2011. The information for the highlights, yeah, the contractual information is out there, but I guarantee if any of you guys actually sift through it all and read it, there's going to be so much shit that they leave open that's sitting out there that will be negotiated after the fact and brought out in the 2015 Book of Letters. So to say it's all out there is inaccurate, because it's not all out there. It's never been out there going back 50 years. That's not true.
Yeah, and not just saying, like, majority of the membership do not have a legal degree, so to say. And a lot of them ain't going to read 1,000 pages of contract language and understand, because you know you can misinterpret that language at any given point in time. So there's so much that these people are not going to understand, even if they were to look at that language. So I think it's the international's responsibility to clearly state to the membership that there's open-ended contract language before they ratify, and explain to them what language is open and what is not, and explain all that language to the membership.
Exactly. Brian, they should put it in the highlights. This is something that we're still working on.
Well, there shouldn't be no highlight. It should just be a straight-up contract book.
Hang on, fellas. And I agree with everything you guys are saying right now. I'm going to tell you right now. They will never put that information in a highlight package. They will never tell the membership any of this information, because they want these contracts passed. If they put this information out so people understood it, they'd never pass a contract. Are you with me? Are you following with me?
So basically what you're saying is the international leadership is playing their membership. I agree with you, absolutely.
Well, two contracts ago, you heard us on this show. Dick Gaines was talking about it. We said, do not vote on this contract. Why? Because you're going to cap off your pension. You're going to end the defined pension plan. There's all of these things that was going to happen. And I know hundreds of thousands of people heard that. Did it make a difference? No. And just like this last contract, we talked about contracts. My goodness, for 3 weeks we covered, on almost every day, we covered contracts, starting with your guys's, then we went to Chevrolet, and then we went to Ford's contracts. And we pulled all this stuff up, and we found all the bad language that we could find. And it had the worst thing of it was not the tier system, but the worst part of the national contracts for the Detroit 3 was that they changed the pension language and they changed your health care language. The two things we've been fighting for 30 years to keep, they negotiated away. And when you talk about stuff that's in the contract, everybody's right. Going back to Scott and to Jones, they do put certain stuff in that contract, and people just don't catch it. Like when they said two contracts on the highlights, they told everybody right in the highlights that they were going to open, if they needed to, they could open up the contract at any given time if the pensions were causing an undue burden on the corporation. They agreed to that. Bob King agreed to that. You know what I'm saying? And this stuff is there. And then there's another thing that's very similar to that. Oh, here's one for you. We all have this language in your national contract, where mutual parties agree, or where local parties agree, so that it even further removes a question from Solidarity House, which puts a contractual legal obligation back onto a local, where local parties mutually agree. Okay, that stuff's been there for years, and there's a reason why it's there. And people haven't figured out it's not for you, it's against you.
Well, okay,
I'm sorry. You know, go ahead.
We're at 5 minutes left in the show. Did you guys want me to end the show? We lost Rebecca.
I won't be able to pause. I won't be able to stay past 8:30 because we have to go on early again tonight.
Okay.
Not 2 hours, but an hour. But, I mean, if you guys want to keep going, you guys, by all means, keep going, because this is good stuff we're talking about. This is how people learn about what we're talking about. And Jones, you're absolutely right. Letters, book letters. And when Scott Holmeson is correct, this has been the first time that they've actually put the white pages on there. Problem was, it wasn't the complete white pages. I have a copy of the 2011 white pages, and it comes in books. There's full books. And like on this last contract online, it was 5 different books. Well, part of that was missing the letters not to be published. And that's where it talks about the plant closings. It talks about what we call the backroom deals or the open language or the zipper clauses, like you refer to, Brian. Some of that stuff was not published this time. And you need to get an actual, you get everything that's involved around the contract. If you can get a hold of your local president or vice president and have them get you a copy of the white pages, that will be your complete national contract. That includes the letters, the appendages, the memorandums. It's everything. And it's probably going to be about, I don't know, 6-8 inches thick with different books.
And yeah, you should be able to go down there and just ask the financial secretary, local secretary, the majority of them have them, depending on the plant size, and ask them.
Yep.
And I know you got to go, but I just want to read something real quick, and this is just – I think backing up exactly what a lot of people on the show were saying, it's M9 Joint Activities, page 244 of our current national contract. And at the end it says, the Joint Activities Boards shall mutually establish and approve an annual budget based on the circumstances that exist at the time of the budget preparation. I mean, that's just one example of how they leave so much open after all the membership has voted on it, to where they can reconvene on it and move forward with it. And again, this is probably one of at least 4 dozen that are in the national, the language that gave us to vote on and the membership passed. And going back to Brian's point, you're absolutely correct. A lot of the membership does not want to take the time to read through it, or it might be misinterpretation, so on and so forth. You know, but there's so much that they leave open. That way, at a later date and time, they can sit down after it's passed and move forward with it, and the majority membership is none the wiser.
Right. Right.
Cinnamon needs to know if we're going to extend the show. If Scott's got to leave, I said we had a good show tonight. We should end it at 8:30, so it's your guys' call. So
I'm good with that. Yeah, I'm good with that.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have a show next Sunday. If you can make it, we'd appreciate it. And we've definitely got a lot more stuff to talk about because, like I said, the more we talk about this, the more people hear it and they start to understand what we're talking about. They can get their heads wrapped around that they have the power. We are the union, not the leadership, the members. We're the union. We're the ones with the power.
Amen, brother.
We need to make sure that our brothers and sisters know that we have that strength and unity, that we can make that difference. That's a hard chore. So, with that being said, I want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving next week. Enjoy your family, your friends, your downtime, whatever you want. Happy Thanksgiving from everybody at the workers. Workplaces and Unions Facebook page also, and from the UAW Factory Whistle Show.
Good deal.
Amen.
Same to you, brother.
There you go.
All right.
Have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
I'm going to work. All right.
Okay.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.